So today I will be talking about measuring smoking in prison settings, and we'll be providing what I hope is an interesting example and look at some different methodological issues surrounding that. I don't have any financial disclosures to report. To give you an overview of what I'd like to cover today, I'd like to begin by providing some general background on incarceration in the United States in general and looking specifically at the place of tobacco in prisons, hopefully tying in with the broader themes of the conference this year. Then I'll move on with a brief description of the project from which the data was drawn, move on to presenting the results from that, looking at several different ways of analyzing that data, and finally discuss some of the methodological implications. So first, a brief look at incarceration in the United States. I'm not sure how much awareness people here may have of the issue of mass incarceration, but the United States currently does have the highest incarceration rates of any nation in the world. This trend started in about the mid-1970s when there was a movement away from indeterminate sentencing, where prisoners were often released early on parole or other forms of supervision. And populations really started to grow at a very rapid rate after that. We've now reached a point where we are incarcerating 1% of American adults at any given time in our jails and prisons. So this is a very significant issue. But just looking at overall rates hides some of the disparities within those numbers. As you can see, there are some very great disparities in racial, ethnic, as well as gender groups. So we can see that in their lifetimes, nearly one-third of African-American males can expect to be incarcerated, compared to less than 1% of white females. So there are some very broad disparities within there. So why should we be interested in examining things in the prison setting? Well, I guess perhaps a crass reason is simply the high economic costs associated with this group. We can see that in 1980, less than $10 billion per year were being spent covering the costs of incarceration. By next year, that number is expected to grow to around $75 billion a year. So there's very high costs, and a big part of that cost is the healthcare costs associated with caring for prisoners. Also, an important thing to note is that most prisoners will return home to their communities at some point in their life. So incarceration may be for an extended period of time, but it's usually not forever. So these people will be returning to communities and will be impacting the health of those communities that they return to. Also, this setting offers a unique public health opportunity. Prisoners tend to be poorer, sicker, and less well-educated than the general population, and often hard-to-reach groups are overrepresented in this prison population. So from a public health perspective, this can be an ideal point for intervention, as it's a gathering point of otherwise hard-to-reach individuals. Now to look briefly at the specific issue of tobacco in prisons. Tobacco has a long history in the prison setting. Some of you may be surprised to know that as recently as the mid-1980s, many prisons, majority of prison systems, were still distributing free tobacco to their inmates. It was viewed very much as kind of a human rights issue, something that prisoners were entitled to having access to. So that certainly has shaped patterns of tobacco use in prisons. Also, tobacco has rightly earned its reputation as a currency in prison black markets. Because of its durability, portability, division into natural units, it made a very natural currency for within that setting. So that's been a role that it's played and has also shaped tobacco use patterns. Past surveys have found very high prevalence of tobacco use among prisoners, with estimates generally ranging from 60 to upwards of 80%. So the prevalence within this population is very high, again, making it an ideal point for targeting interventions and an important point to be studied in this population. So the study that I'll be talking with you today about is the STOP project. It was targeted at assessing smoking and tobacco in Ohio prisons. This was a survey of prisoners at two facilities in Ohio. 200 male inmates, low to medium security inmates, were asked to report on their tobacco use prior to and during incarceration. A modified NHANES tobacco questionnaire was used for those questions. And also some tobacco biomarkers were collected as part of the study. Saliva samples were collected for cotinine testing, and breath tests were conducted for exhaled carbon monoxide levels using a handheld tester. The data was collected between May and August of 2008. A few notes on the various biomarker tests that were examined here. Cotinine was assessed using two different assays. Liquid chromatography, dual mass spectrometry, was kind of the traditionally more accurate version of the test. That costs around $25 per sample. Those were analyzed at an external lab. Also used was an enzyme immunoassay, which is a slightly cheaper but somewhat less reliable test. And so I was interested in comparing those. And again, the exhaled carbon monoxide was measured using a handheld monitor. And there's a high initial cost for purchasing the monitor, but then a very low per test cost once that initial cost has been made. So now to get into presenting some of those results. I was interested in evaluating what the performance of these various measures was, but in order to evaluate performance, we need to be comparing to some sort of a standard. The initial question, as it was presented in the grant application and as was written up in the dissertation chapter that came out of this data, was looking at the question, do objective measures of tobacco use, so do biomarkers support the validity of self-report? So in this case, liquid chromatography dual mass spec for cotinine was treated as the gold standard and assumed to be completely accurate in assessing smoking status. And based on that assumption, we saw that there was strong performance, both in terms of sensitivity of the test for self-reported tobacco use measures, but slightly lower specificity of the test. And performance of enzyme immunoassay was comparable to the liquid chromatography in terms of specificity, but did have a somewhat higher false negative results, resulting in a lower sensitivity of that test. And the poorest performance of these tests as a single point in time measure was the carbon monoxide breath testing. So this was the way things were initially written up and submitted for publication. And reviewer response coming back said that they thought perhaps a more interesting question, or the question they were interested in seeing assessed, was how well do biomarkers perform if we assume that self-reported tobacco use status was actually the true measure of tobacco use in this population. So in this case, the gold standard was assumed to be self-report. And again, since there was high sensitivity and specificity of that based off the other measure, as you might expect, the liquid chromatography showed good agreement, again, high sensitivity and specificity. And similar results, not much change, and I'll go through a comparison of the tests kind of head-to-head here in just a second. So each of these methods, we had to assume one measure or another was a perfect assessment of smoking status. Now that might seem like a bad assumption to be making on either part. We can think of limitations where both of them may end up producing false results. So a third alternative, a third strategy for analyzing these results is to ask, how did these tests perform if we use the results from all of them to try to develop a better assessment of overall performance? So in this case, it was using a latent class analysis to look at the outcomes of each of the tests then. And what we find is that in this case, because of the relatively strong performance of the tests, we end up with very similar results. So again, high sensitivity, slightly lower specificity for the self-report measures, the strongest measure probably being the liquid chromatography, followed by enzyme immunoassay, and lowest performance among the carbon monoxide breath testing. So to view all of these results kind of more head-to-head to allow for direct comparisons, looking at the sensitivity of the measures Again, we can see that the results are fairly consistent here, within a few percentage points for most of the tests across the range. When we look at specificity, however, we can see that there's slightly more variability here. This is reflecting the lower prevalence of smoking within the sample. Only about 20% were non-smokers. So with those smaller numbers, that led to greater variability in the estimates with reclassification of only a few individuals. So a summary of what we can take from these different means of analysis about these different measures. First, when it comes to self-reported smoking status, we seem to find strong support that this is, in fact, a valid measure of tobacco use among prisoners. It's a low-cost option relative to the other tests, so simply asking a question is cheaper than sending off the samples for analysis. It also allows for the researchers to capture much more detail about patterns in smoking. So we don't just know, do you smoke or don't you smoke, but we can know details of patterns of use. So do you tend to have long durations between smoking episodes? We can ask questions about how much tobacco you're using. It really provides much more detail in that sense. There does seem to be some misreporting, particularly among individuals who reported recently having quit smoking. And it may be differences in interpretation of the question of do you smoke or not. So it seems that sensitivity may be able to be improved by clarifying the questions that are asked, perhaps explicitly stating even one puff to say that even a brief lapse in cessation should be noted when reporting those results. Looking then at liquid chromatography dual mass spec, this appeared to be the most valid of the biomarkers for measuring at a single point in time, which was what we were examining here. It did show a high sensitivity, and this is probably due to the long half-life of cotinine relative to something like carbon monoxide. The cost of this test, though, is a potential downside. When we look at the slightly cheaper enzyme immunoassay test, the primary challenge with this test is that it did seem to produce some false negative results. Oftentimes, we're most interested in confirming cessation or confirming non-use of tobacco when we're using this test. So it really is a concern that the test would yield false negatives. However, it is possible that a two-stage screening protocol may still be a cost-effective method for assessing smoking status, in which you initially use an enzyme immunoassay and then rescreen with the liquid chromatography dual mass spec as a means of confirming the results of that test. Finally, carbon monoxide breath testing. This did have the lowest performance as a standalone test. This is probably due to the relatively short half-life of carbon monoxide. And what we saw based on the self-reports of prisoners was that smoking in prison, though many individuals were smoking, they tended to smoke less frequently due to the high cost of tobacco in that setting. This led to longer gaps between smoking, and the carbon monoxide test is missing some of those, or testing negative in some of those gaps. So what this might indicate is that with repeated testing, the carbon monoxide test performance may well improve and be able to capture some of that variation. The low cost of this test does make it an ideal option for situations in which repeated testing is necessary. For something like confirming cessation, this might be a good test compared to something like cotinine. And also timing of the test may be especially important for this test given the shorter half-life. So taking into account things like when prisoners have access to tobacco, so if there are certain days when they're going to the commissary and able to purchase that, they may be more likely to smoke in the days immediately following that. So that may be the best time to assess, or also certain times of day, making sure it's later in the day so you capture any smoking events during that day. So what are the methodological implications that hopefully this example has highlighted? First, we know that true gold standards are rare. Oftentimes, the fairly simplistic methods of assessing sensitivity and specificity using kind of the 2x2 table methods that we might learn in general epidemiology class is appealing because of their simplicity, but we need to recognize that oftentimes our assumptions are not entirely accurate. And so we need to take that into account and consider what sort of biases we may be introducing by making those assumptions. A strategy like latent class analysis doesn't require a gold standard, which may be beneficial, but there are other assumptions that are being made, and so those assumptions need to be taken into account. The latent class analysis does assume conditional independence, so the errors in one test are not associated with errors in other tests. This may not be a particularly good assumption. In this case, looking at two separate assays for cotinine, we would expect that potentially those errors might be related since they're measuring the same chemical to arrive at their conclusions. Finally, one note about the results that are presented here. These results were conducted or were drawn from a sample in a setting where tobacco use was still allowed. In recent years, there's been a dramatic shift in tobacco policy in prisons. Many prisons are moving to a total ban on tobacco products within their grounds, and that potentially could have a strong impact on patterns of usage, which may in turn impact the performance of these tests. I would like to acknowledge others who assisted with this project, colleagues from the Ohio State University College of Public Health, Doctors Amy Furkatich, Mary Ellen Wewers, and David Murray, and from the Department of Sociology, Dr. Paul Belair. Also funding sources, development of the project was supported by the Behavioral Cooperative Oncology Group of the Walter Cancer Institute. The project itself was supported by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention through an R36, and also I'd like to recognize the R25 for supporting my travel here. And I believe we'll have a time for questions at the end. So, have a few minutes. So if anyone has questions now. Yes, sir.
I wonder if you considered if you could get agreement from the prisons to introduce different cessation interventions within the prison population. Use this measurement process to determine time of cessation, but then compare the intervention groups in terms of something like median time to cessation. It seems to me that would be a very informative for future users of these different intervention methods.
I think interventions would be an ideal, I think the prison setting is an ideal setting for introduction of interventions. As I had mentioned, there's kind of these shifts in prison tobacco policies. This movement towards total tobacco bans. Unfortunately, what we've been seeing is, even though we know forced abstinence is very different from cessation, pretty much any cessation programming tends to be stopping within prisons when they move to those total tobacco bans. So it's becoming a bit more challenging of a topic to study these days as prisons push in that direction. But I think it would be an ideal project. I think it's a wonderful idea. So. Hopefully we can find someone who would agree to do something like that.
Do you have time for one question?
Another? Yes.
As I understand, biomarker may be affected by secondhand smoking behavior, especially the prison has a higher level of smoking prevalence. So how did you address this issue?
The prisons where this took place did have an indoor smoking ban, which hopefully minimized secondhand smoke exposure, but certainly didn't eliminate it completely. In terms of assessing that, we do have the multiple measures. There isn't really an objective way. We don't have any, unfortunately, any indoor air quality measures that we're directly assessing levels of smokeless tobacco. I think the fact that we are seeing high agreement between the self-report tests and the others does seem to support that we are detecting true smoking as opposed to false positive results resulting from secondhand smoke exposure. I guess another factor kind of measuring into that is so many people are smoking, the number of non-smokers being exposed is a relatively small segment of that population. Thank you very much.